It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. My guests today are Jeff Landfield and Paxson Wilbur from the Alaska Landmine. The two journalists were the first to expose the battle over the Stewart Trail, a South Anchorage neighborhood road that has become a disputed point of access to Chugach State Park. Our conversation will cover the early history of the Stewart Trail, to the beginning of the dispute centered around a new landowner, to the current legal standing of trail access. This interview with Jeff and Paxson is the first part of a two-part series on the Stewart Trail. Next week, I'll have two neighbors who have been on opposite sides of allowing access through the Stewart Trail, but are finding ways to work together now that the legal dispute is nearing a conclusion. Welcome to Outdoor Explorer, Jeff and Paxson.
Yeah, thanks for having us. Happy to be here.
First timer, very excited.
Yeah. And so that kind of brings me to the part of the introduction where I want the two of you to talk about how you began to collaborate together, because Jeff, you're really known for doing a lot of political stories and, you know, well known for that. And Paxson, you've done a lot of stories for the Landmine, and some have been political, but a lot of outdoor oriented ones. So how did the two of you first get together and start to collaborate?
That's actually a really funny story. I ran for the Senate in 2016, the state Senate. And I got hooked up with this guy, Cale Green, who was kind of running the campaign, and he was starting to do video stuff. And we were doing the website and all the campaign things. And then at one point he had this guy, quote unquote, this guy who was doing graphic stuff and web stuff. And the product was really good. And for months I was like, who's this guy? And sometimes in like graphics or media or anything, IT, whatever, people have people they use and they don't want to introduce them to the client, because they don't want to have that like direct access. And it eventually became this kind of running joke where I was like, I want to meet this guy. And then we met. That was in like 2015, probably.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And then we you know, political world, Paxson was doing campaign stuff. And then I went to Australia for a year in 2017, and I built a little travel blog, and Paxson built it. And we were at that point friends. And we just kept in touch when I was in Australia, and he was managing my travel blog website. And then
that's a memory of mine. I remember reading your travel blog, and one of you or both of you, or maybe it was Cale, went to Mexico for medical treatment.
Yeah, that was
Cale.
Yeah.
Okay.
I told Cale, I said, you have to video document this.
Yeah.
And he did. And you know, cause he broke his collarbone, and it was much cheaper to go get it done over there.
So Paxson, did you know about Jeff when you first met him? Did you already know about him?
I mean, I was just getting these really weird graphic requests from Cale, who was managing Jeff's campaign. Normally I'm doing like flyers and whatever, but the requests for Jeff's campaign, it was like make him look like a three-tone, like kind of like the Obama Hope poster, but with like really weird slogans. And I was like, man, this is just really strange for a political campaign, but it was pretty fun work. And then Jeff started doing, after we met, Jeff started doing the Landmine, and I built the website. And then,
well, that was after I came back from Australia.
Yeah.
And he had done the, you know, travel. And I said, I want to start doing political, because AmandaCoin.com was no longer around. And then Casey Reynolds was kind of gone. Matt Buxton could come in, but there just wasn't, you know, because I'd run for office before, there wasn't a lot of real political coverage happening.
Mm-hmm.
And then I said, Paxson, I want to start this. Remember we were trying to name it?
Yeah, Jeff put it out for kind of public comment on social media and just asked somebody to suggest a name, and someone said Landmine, so we just kind of thought that was good and ran with it.
It was from Cafe Del Mundo. We came up with the idea and the name and everything on some random October day.
So the name, which seems so perfect for what you do, was originally came out as a suggestion from somebody?
From a guy named Ivan Hodes. So
Ivan?
We had like, you know, dozens or hundreds of comments, and you know, we were like the Ledger and like whatever, we had all these names, and we just couldn't come up with a name. And then I said, I'm gonna put it out there, and someone said Landmine, and I go, Paxson, Alaska Landmine. He's like, oh my god,
that's perfect. It's amazing. It's so great when those things happen, when all of a sudden you're like, yeah, of course it should be called that.
Yeah, the tagline was it was originally explosive political news, and then now it's explosive Alaska news, because we do a lot of writing that's outside of politics, although it's still oriented around political reporting.
Well, all life is politics, right?
Yeah, and as it turns out, trail access is a very political issue as well. Public
Thank
access.
You for that segue. That was awesome.
Yeah,
yeah, that was really good.
Explorer,
so. So yeah, the reason I have you guys on, and I contacted you over a year ago about this, saying I want to talk about recreational access to public lands. And I really appreciated that both of you responded to me right away. And then I didn't do anything for a year and a half. And then the Stewart Trail lawsuit was, the initial lawsuit was settled. And then I reached out to you again. So now we're here first to talk about the Stewart Trail. And then today, I hope we'll have enough time to talk about Campbell Lake and maybe some other public access. And if not, we'll come back for another show. But so let's talk about the Stewart Trail. And first, can you just give an explanation of the history of the trail?
So the Stewart Trail is in Upper Potter Valley. It's basically the sole access to a very large amount of terrain right behind Anchorage. And it was put in the 1960s by the Stewarts. And they are the same Stewarts who founded Stewart Photo downtown. And they're also responsible for Star the Reindeer. They were this really iconic, amazing early Anchorage couple. They were kind of eccentric and really smart, and just seemed like really great people. They traveled around the state in an amphibious vehicle. And they are largely responsible for the association with jade in Alaska. So they were the ones who really developed the kind of jade industry based out of Kobuk Valley, based on Kobuk Valley jade. So they have this really cool part of role in Anchorage history. And they bought a homestead tract in the Upper Potter Valley area. And they built this road, which became known as the Stewart Road, or Stewart's Road, or the Stewart Trail. And basically, they bulldozed this thing in, and then they just allowed anybody, or I shouldn't, you have to be really precise with some of this language related to easements. Basically, they didn't take any action one way or another as far as public use of that corridor went. So it was this really incredible access for McHugh Peak behind Anchorage. And they just were, you know, the right phrase to use is probably, you know, they acquiesced to public use of the road or the trail. And it just became the de facto, it became the standard route up McHugh Peak. And it was listed in guidebooks. So going back decades, the guidebooks would say, oh, you want to climb McHugh Peak, go up Stewart's Road. And then from there, ascend the west summit of McHugh, which is Ruby. So it just became a very well-used, very kind of beloved public access point. And it's a really wonderful trail, and it is to this day. It has a really nice low grade. It has amazing views of Turnagain Arm. It's south-facing, so it gets really nice direct light all winter long, as long as the sun is out anyway. There's light on the Stewart Trail, so it's a really beautiful community asset, and it has been for, you know, decades, for, I don't know, what is it, 50, 70, 60 years, you know, something like that, a long time, very, you know, long-standing, wonderful community trail.
So the funny thing is that I had never been up there until about 10 days ago. My brother had been up there quite a bit though, backcountry skiing, so he was really familiar with it, but I don't ever remember. I asked him when we were up there if we had ever gone up there as kids, because our dad took us hiking every weekend, and he didn't ever remember us being up there before, because at that point when I was young, it was pretty remote to get up there. But do you remember going up there as a kid, Paxson? Did you do stuff up there as a kid?
I did not. I don't think I ever did go on the Stewart Trail as a kid. I climbed McHugh when I was pretty young, but we did it from McHugh Creek.
Mm-hmm. Your dad used it?
Yeah, but my dad has skied up there for decades since he moved to Alaska. So yeah, it wasn't as well known, of course, as Glen Alps or some of the big official trailheads. It was used predominantly probably by people in that neighborhood. There were a lot of people who grew up in the surrounding neighborhoods who used that trail every single day, mm-hmm. Or, you know, very, very often, just because it was right there and had such good access to McHugh. But yeah, I didn't personally. I was kind of amazed. Well, actually, when I tried to go use it for the first time, I found the gate that had been built across it to keep people out. The Stewart Trail is the main corridor in that area, but over the decades, people in the neighborhoods have built dozens of little
social trails
kind of spidering all over that valley.
Yeah. And I have to say, you know, it definitely isn't like a single track trail. It looks like a road. It's definitely, you get on it, it looks like a dirt road, right?
Yeah, well, it was bulldozed in the 60s, and then it really grew over quite a bit and became what you call an alder tunnel. And then a developer or a landowner back there, I think, had some plans to widen the road back out to its original width, and then have one of the, it's a LRSA, which is a limited road service area organization. So an organization that maintains roads on the hillside. I think he or they wanted LRSA to take over maintenance of the road, but the what I was told is the local LRSA basically balked and said, this road is really built badly. There's no drainage, and it's bulldozed in on a bunch of organics. So really nobody wants responsibility for maintaining that road road.
And you could drive a car in there, but before Frank put up the what I call the Stasi gate, there was a smaller little gate to prevent vehicle traffic. So there was like the stewards put that up, right? The little,
yeah. So kind of a really sad part of this story is that somebody went up there, you know, a couple decades ago and burned down a couple of the structures that were in Upper Powder Valley, including the Stewart's amphibious vehicle, which had been parked up there. And at that point, I think at that point, a vehicle gate was installed, which prevented vehicles from driving up into Upper Powder Valley. But walkers, skiers, bikers were always good to keep using it.
And there's, so to this trail, there's a bunch of land up there that's not just, well, you can get to Chugach State Park, obviously, but after Earl Stewart died, their homestead went to the Alaska Botanical Garden and the Alaska Zoo.
Yeah, right? That's
so
right.
They're owners up there, but there's also access to tracts owned by the Heritage Land Bank and the State Department of Natural Resources. So there's a lot of,
well, and there's Brewster and there's that Mattinaw, right?
Brewster's is on the other side of that.
Other side. Yeah, my brother pointed Brewster's out because he said that would be another way they would go up to backcountry ski some of that in that off of McHugh Peak area.
Yeah, and actually the Brewster's area, there's a little bit of controversy about access, public access in that area too. Unfortunately, there's problems with public access pretty much across the entire face of Chugach State Park due to just really sloppy land use decisions and grown up a little people need to be pretty attentive to this stuff, and when you're not attentive to land use and access, it creates just the problems multiply as you go.
Well, not far away on Honeybear, you have these homeowners putting up their own damn, you know, no parking signs, and they're saying people are going to get fined. Mm-hmm. And we measured the road, and the road is well within the length, over the length of, what is it, 60 feet? What is it?
It has to be over 20 feet.
20 feet.
20 feet.
Yeah. Yeah, and yeah. You know, there's plenty of space like that, but they put up these signs and tell people they can't park there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's the Stewart Trail is just one of many, many problems with access on the hillside. But sorry, were you trying to ask a question there?
No, but I do have other questions. So kind of what we're facing, I think, is a lot like California and Hawaii have faced with their beaches, getting public access to beaches over private land. It's just that, well, not Hawaii, but California, we're just younger and are now having all these growing pains. Or what has been going on that has created this situation where we have these private holdings that are stopping access to public recreation?
Land use is very complicated, and there are a lot of reasons for problems to occur. One pretty obvious source of problems is, you know, inadequate parking at existing trailheads. Another set of problems is that you'll have a longstanding historical access that nobody ever sort of bothers to, you know, on a governmental level, bothers to defend sufficiently. Or, Ram Valley is another situation where you have, you know, you had decades of access, and probably RS-2477 easement should have been created there at one point. And
so,
it just
what is that? What does that mean? There was a bunch of letters and numbers there. I didn't keep track of all of them.
So there are different types of access to places like Chugach State Park, and the best types of access are platted easements, roadway or pedestrian easements. And then there are what are called prescriptive easements, which the idea behind a prescriptive easement, these date back to the 13th century, you know, English common law, but they're also a very central part of American private property law. And they basically say, if you acquiesce to a public corridor, a public transportation corridor across private property, you don't get to shut it down decades later and kind of tear up the social fabric and potentially strand, you know, stop commerce, stop the flow of people and goods. So they're very important to our system of private kind of Western private property ownership.
Like the RS-2477 was back in the 1860s when they were kind of developing as they kept going west. If you go to the East Coast, there's land usage is more complicated. And they started doing these kind of mile blocks. What are they called?
So those are section line easements. So when Alaska was basically, when Alaska became a state, this 1x1 mile grid was put over basically the entire state. And that the lines on that grid were reserved for section line easements, which mean that you can develop them for, you know, trails and roads and such. So most of the major roads in Anchorage, for example, are on this section line easement grid. So section line easements are one way that you can have access to places like Chugach State Park. They're not always ideal because there are straight lines on this 1x1 mile grid. And sometimes they end up going up really steep grades or crossing ravines or something. So it's better to have access that follows the topography of a certain area. But land use planners have to recognize that and sort of make good access official and encourage and develop good appropriate public access to places like Chugach State Park. Otherwise you get weird little things where people are creeping along the edge of private property for a few dozen feet, or you have to make prescriptive easement arguments, which is what we were we're talking about with the Stewart Trail, or you just end up with massive overflow parking at you know, inadequate trailheads, and then people crisscrossing and trying to get to places. Like, basically people really want to go to places like Chugach State Park. Mm-hmm. And when the law and city planning doesn't facilitate that, it just creates a lot of problems. And that's what we're stuck with now.
And I would say that, you know, to your initial question about some of these, why these issues have gotten worse or maybe larger, is the more people move to Anchorage, the hillside's grown, there's more houses. Some people move up here from the lower 48, like this guy, Frank Pugh, we can talk about. And, you know, they buy property, they buy houses, and then they decide, wait a minute, you know, this is my, I don't want, you know, people coming here, whether it's public trail or whether it's just a road they don't want people parking on. So you have more people, and some of them buy expensive houses, and they decide this is our area, not anybody else's area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is a huge problem, unfortunately, that a lot of people want to move immediately adjacent to Chugach State Park or to popular Chugach State Park trailheads. And then they work so hard to keep other people out. Mm-hmm. You see that really at the South Fork Eagle River trailhead.
There's a new trail that just went in there, right? Is that the one up in Highland? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you see, we have some public records requests documents from records requests showing how hard the residents or some residents work to keep the public out of their neighborhoods. Some people, they're asking for these totally inappropriate no parking signs.
Remember that guy? We had a guy. So when Paxton was starting to look into this, we had a guy who lives over there contact us. And you could tell he was like, because he was aware of Campbell Lake, he was aware of the Stewart Trail article Paxton did. It was so weird. He basically said, how much money do you need to not write about this?
Whoa.
We were like, oh my God.
Did you start calculating in your head how much money you need not to write about it?
I called Paxton. I was like, this guy is for real. I mean, he wants to pay us off to not do a story.
Figure out how much money he has.
$1 million.
Yeah.
it's wild to me that you would move next to a state park and then spend your time and effort, you know, your precious time on earth, just trying to keep other people from going hiking.
Instead of doing things like trying to figure out how to make the parking better, or, you know, I think there's a legitimate, like, there needs to be some sort of parking There needs to be a way to dispose of trash, and you need to make sure people can get out of the neighborhood if there's a fire, right? I mean, those are the big things that moving forward, this is going to happen. People are going to come into your trail. So let's figure out how to move forward from that.
Well, unfortunately, it's very political, because the people are on the hillside, you know, they're wealthier people. Campbell Lake's another example, right?
Yeah.
So the government, mm-hmm. like the government is probably nervous to do anything, because there's people who live there that are politically connected. You know, Mayor Berkowitz, when he was mayor, they told Pew, the guy who put up the gate on the Stewart Trail, several times, they sent him letters, tear the gate down, you know, and nothing ever came of that. With Campbell Lake, you know, the state and the city acknowledge that there's public access there, but there's some very powerful people that live on Campbell Lake. Mm-hmm. And then the state and the city do nothing to facilitate the access, because mm-hmm. you're dealing with very powerful, connected people who probably can pick up the phone and say, what are you doing? Don't build a road here. Don't build a trail here.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that is definitely another problem with public access generally, that there's an unwillingness or inability by state or local authorities to actually assert or enforce very valid public access, you know, existing public access. So in the case of the Stewart Trail, and we haven't actually explained this yet, but a man named Frank Pugh purchased a lot bisected by the Stewart Trail in 2012, and then he built this giant kind of very ugly, like very amateurish, but like kind of awful barbed wire top.
It looks like across it. It looks like something the Stasi would build in East Germany.
Yeah, we've called it
pretty hardcore.
You know, an East German Eagle Scout project. It's just kind of this.
And then he's built up on the sides. He's like got these like natural barriers of like wood that he's put in there, or dead branches.
It's just bizarre.
And it's really weird. Yeah.
The effort that people will anyway.
Yeah. You know, he bought that property in 2012, right?
Yeah, that's right. And he
and then and I should mention here, and I'll put a link to your article, One Man's Mountain. It was in 2019 that you wrote about this, and it's very extensively researched. And the point that you made about him when he bought that was that he holds control over more land in Anchorage than any other individual.
Yeah, because the Stewart Trail is the only access point to Upper Potter Valley. He built this gate, and he just declared that he had the right to shut down the Stewart Trail. And by claiming that right, that he was effectively claiming the right to control hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousand, maybe over 1,000 acres of Anchorage. Mm-hmm. And the municipality sent him three letters saying, hey, this is very clearly a prescriptive easement. Look, it's in, you know, guidebooks going back decades. It's been continuously used by the public. And Pugh just ignored it. And the municipality just said, okay, and didn't follow up. And I think that really disappointed a lot of people and rubbed people the wrong way, that, you know, if the municipality is gonna send legal letters, you know, or basically orders to people and then not follow up, then you really have, you know, not very much reason to listen to the municipal attorney if you can just ignore them.
He actually became for a while president of Rabbit Creek Community Council. Extremely combative. We went to a meeting once years ago, and he saw us, and he set his sights on us, and it was for the people there. He was literally combatively arguing with people in the community about all kinds of issues, and he was like, "I am the president," and we're like, "Oh my god!" Like, I was president of a community council. I've been involved in community councils, and it attracts different kind of people, but I think he was there for just like one term because people got so sick of it.
So I heard a little bit about this from the Reynolds, who are landowners near that, about how the community council was taken over by Frank, and Mackinac, I think, was part of this at some point too. I'm not sure. So we'll have to talk about Mackinac.
Mackinac was the secretary treasurer.
Mackinac, yeah.
During when he was president, Matthew Kavanaugh, whatever. Mackinac, was also on the, you know, community council leadership.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. We are going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll hear more from Jeff Landfield and Paxson Welber of the Alaska Landmine.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store, or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. My guests are Jeff Landfield and Paxson Welber of the Alaska Landmine. I'm also would like to talk about how that happens. How does somebody take over a community council like that? Is it pretty easy because
Very
people
easy.
Aren't paying attention?
All you have to really do is have a bunch of people show up to the meeting where they're having elections. And this happens sometimes. You have 5 or 10 or 20 of your friends show up, and anybody who lives in the area is a member of the community council. Some are a little more proactive about having membership lists and all that, but this is very common where someone's mad about something, some, you know, land issue, there's maybe some restaurant bar problem or noise, whatever, and they just, you know, have their friend show up to the meeting, and they be, and, you know, you need 5 or 10 people usually, and they get elected president. And that's all it takes.
And we can, I mean, I think we could argue that community councils are probably the little body of government that affects people the most because they're the closest to your what's happening in your neighborhood.
Except they have no, I mean, they don't have any real power to make any decisions. They can, you know, tell the assembly, we voted on this and this is what we want. And they get listened to by the assembly usually, but they don't have any, you know, actual decision-making power.
Mm-hmm. So then what year did he come in, like, how did he know, did he have like the neighbors who were at him, like saying, open this up. And then he'd gotten these letters and he's like, I'm going to go in and take over the community council. And then what was his plan or what did he do after that?
Yeah. This whole story is just so strange. So he put up the gate in I believe 2016 and, the municipality, you know, the neighbors, basically were saying, we're not going to stand for this. This is our community trail. And the municipality told Frank, this is a public trail, take your gate down. But because the municipality didn't act, it created this really kind of slightly dangerous situation where the people in the neighborhood and the community kept using the trail, but Frank would drive up to people and get really angry if they refused to sign this access agreement that said, you know, I acknowledge that Frank Pugh owns this trail and can control it and kick people off whenever. So some people signed this access agreement, and then other people told, you know, were familiar with the municipality's position and just told them to kick dirt. And this just really, really angered him.
Like Medrin.
Yeah.
Oh,
or like
okay.
us
okay.
for that matter, although he never asked us to sign the access agreement. But you know, basically we ended up with this armed, you know, very conspicuously armed guy patrolling this trail and making, you know, accosting people and making demands of people and people just saying, no, I'm not going to play ball with you. And it created a lot of really tense and sketchy situations.
I think he didn't have a revolver, you know?
Yeah, he would, you know, and there's bears and it's Alaska and what, you know, it's legal to carry a gun, but quite a few people commented to us that they found it kind of disturbing that this really angry guy was coming up to them and making demands of them with this, you know, big gun on his hip, and people just found it very threatening and upsetting. And you know, this is their community trail, and people were really upset at what was going on. So also he created this very extensive network of hidden, or you know, some hidden and some not, game cameras, and he started filming and photographing people and then publishing these just bizarre videos and sending the photos around everywhere, and it was just a really bad situation.
There's like some of the game cameras are actually can take video. So back in 2019, Paxson, myself, Chris Birch, who passed away, the state senator, and then Chris Constant from the assembly, we all walked on the trail one fall afternoon, and then later Pugh lost his mind and started saying that elected officials and Jeff Landfield and Paxson Welber were trespassing. And some of the game cameras had video capability, and they like an audio too. So I'm telling a joke that if you didn't really understand the context of the joke, it sounds like I'm saying something pretty weird. And he puts it all on YouTube. I mean, the guy is
well,
like,
well, Jeff,
nuts.
I do have to say that lots of times things you say can be taken as quite weird. So I don't know if that's out of the realm of anybody being surprised by.
Jeff was actually quoting a really weird article that somebody had written. So he was saying, he was like quoting somebody else, but in the video, it made it sound like he was saying that. So it's just,
okay.
it wasn't actually Jeff.
It was involving Australians and going to Japan.
Yeah, it's
and
not important.
It's not important, but it was weird. It was a weird, but it was caught on audio. And because some of these game cameras are, you know, recording video and audio. And then, you know, he's calling into like the radio stations and he's declaring us trespassers. And, you know, he's really mad at Chris Birch, who was a kind of conservative Republican.
Yeah.
Right, which is kind of weird. I think that's kind of Frank's people. And then Constant obviously is more of a progressive on the assembly, but both of them were very much in favor of public access.
Mm-hmm.
Straight to the
I think that's kind of what a lot of these points are, is that people on both sides, this is something we can agree on in Alaska, is that we want access to our public lands. And it is, but we are also very much NIMBYs, you know, so the people who live next door don't necessarily want you going across their land or next to their land.
I don't feel that I'm a NIMBY personally. Like, I'm pretty okay with people building, you know, developing around my.
Well, I am too, you guys are very close to me right now, and we're going to be probably faced with a huge homeless shelter close to us where we are, your office and my house. And so I don't mind that either, but a lot of people seem to be pretty upset.
I was going to say before, ironically, John Sturgeon is celebrated as a hero by especially conservatives for him fighting the federal government about access, you know, the Yukon Charlie with his hovercraft. So
that's right.
Our government is really happy to go all the way to the Supreme Court and support Sturgeon going after our state government, going after the federal government, mm-hmm. right? But when it comes to going after or asserting access, when it comes to private individuals, they aren't as excited. But Sturgeon is celebrated as this folk hero for standing up to the man about public access.
Yeah. So I want to go back to the prescriptive public easement definition for a second, because we talked about it being continuous. There's been a long history on the Stuart Trail, people using it. It's been open. People have been able to access that. And then the other one is hostile. That's the third piece of it. And that doesn't mean that you're having hostilities on the trail, but that's what Frank was trying to do, right? He was trying to get people to acknowledge it was his land and he was giving them permission to be on it. Because the idea behind hostile is that it's used without permission and with no apparent value to the landowner.
So yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
So that's what he was trying to do, right? Is saying, oh, there's no, so if he could say that this isn't hostile, they're all agreeing, I own this land and I'm giving them permission, then it wouldn't fall under the prescriptive public easement. That's what I'm assuming he was trying to.
That's my assumption as well, that he was trying to make the use of that, easement, or make an argument that the use of that easement was, you know, permissive, and therefore, you know, it would eventually eliminate the easement, maybe. So I think that's why he was so angry when people refused to sign his agreement, because they were essentially saying, no, this is already a well-established public access corridor. I'm not using it with your permission. And that helps keep it open legally. It's worth noting too here, maybe, that it's an interesting piece of land. It's 120 acres, and he paid, I think, a little bit over $300,000 for it. Someone was willing to dig up the private real estate records for transactions. And that is an insanely low amount to pay per acre. The reason that it was so cheap, this large tract of land, is that it would be astronomically expensive to develop land up there. You'd have to build, you know, roads, potentially multiple roads. You would have to just do an enormous amount of work to subdivide land like that. So it didn't have, you know, a huge amount of value on the books, but the value in the land came from, a lot of the value in the land came from the trail. Mm-hmm. And Pew, a couple land use organizations tried to negotiate with him to say, hey, you know, we'll give you a little bit of money to just take your gate down, dedicate this as an easement, and just, you know, like, let's knock this off. And he wanted a lot of money to reopen it. So, and these, you know, public access groups basically said, well, you know, this is a public trail anyway, we're not going to really give you that much to take your gate down. It should be down anyway. So they really kind of balked at the idea of spending huge amounts of money to reopen what was already a public trail. But Pew really wanted, he bought this land knowing that there was a very well-established public trail on it. There had been for decades. And he gated it off, blocked the public, you know, blocked the community from accessing their community trail. And then he wanted a huge payout to reopen it. So, I think that's just incredibly antisocial behavior in Alaska. And that is not what Alaska, at least to me, that is not what Alaska is about. I mean, people live here because of access to the outdoors, and a lot of people do anyway. And, you know, to come up here, I believe Pew's from Louisiana, you know, he's not even, you know, lifelong Alaskan or, you know, longtime resident or anything. He just came up here, basically bought a trail, closed it, and then kind of demanded a lot of, you know, money to reopen it. That it really turned a huge number of people off.
He was going for the shakedown.
And that, I think, is when this community group, Friends of the Stewart Trail, formed. And that was made up of a lot of people from the neighborhood and other people in the community who had used the Stewart Trail. And this community group got together and sued Frank. And it took years, but they won. And Judge Crosby, a Superior Court Judge Crosby here in Anchorage, just a couple weeks ago, just this is why we're on your program, by the way, for anybody listening.
Yeah.
She said, hey, this trail overwhelmingly meets the definition of a prescriptive easement. You know, and she didn't order the gate to be taken down or anything, but that'll happen in the next. She basically told the parties, you know, this is a prescriptive easement. Now, she gave them a little bit of time to say what they would like to have happen next. And undoubtedly, Friends of the Stewart Trail will say, we want Frank to take his gate down and probably start following and stop harassing people on the trail.
We have a little project that we're working on, too, involving that.
Oh, you do? How much do you want to tell me about it?
Stay tuned.
We hope to do a group hike, you know, eventually one of these days.
I'm talking about our
I know what you're talking about.
We have something awesome in store.
Jeff just can't help himself.
I'll say it, but I think that it's Paxton's kind of baby, so we'll be gone.
You don't want to give any, but it's about the Stewart Trail. Do you want to give any other little nuggets?
Oh, it's about Frank specifically.
I am just going to say I am really looking forward to using our community trail again. And that's that.
And let me just say that this guy, Paxton and I used the trail last year, and this psycho had the police come to my house. I'm not even sure how that's possible, how he was able to get, maybe it was a rookie or something, but the APD, the city has told him this is a civil matter, this is in the court, this is not a criminal matter. But somehow he was able to get the two APD, I wasn't home, somebody was in my buddy was in my house, my roommate, and I get a call, the cops are here, and I'm like, okay, sure. And he's like, no, they're really looking for you. Like, and I said, what? And he says something about some trail use. And I said, is this a joke? So I actually got the cop left his number. I called him. I was at the Matanuska Brewing Company. I said, come arrest me right now. I'm here. Come get me. And obviously they didn't want to arrest me, but they wanted to either intimidate me or maybe they knew. I don't know how Frank got them to do that. But
no, I don't think the cops want to. I doubt they wanted to intimidate. So part of the problem, because there was this weird legal situation where the municipality said, this is a legal trail. Frank Pugh would just constantly call the cops on people for using it. And, you know, the cops don't necessarily understand land use on this upper Powder Valley. So the cops would go to people and say, hey, you know, we got this report that you were trespassing on a trail. And then people would have to explain, no, it's a public trail. This guy Frank just does this. So it was really, really an abuse of police resources.
At that point, they had a kind of memo saying, look, this is not an APD matter. That was kind of... on the books, or that was something that officers were told. So maybe it was a newer officer or whatever, but
yeah,
but after that, you know, I had to go to the assembly and testify and say, he was actually sitting right behind me when I testified. He was right there. Remember that?
Oh yeah.
And I said, this guy's a psychopath and he's calling the cops and having, you know, government resources come to citizens for using a trail.
Yeah. I mean, individual officers didn't necessarily understand the situation, right. But, APD is a department of the Anchorage municipality. So the municipality's position is it's a public trail. So nobody was ever arrested or cited or fined or anything for using this trail.
That is pretty extreme to have officers sent to your house.
I would have loved to have been arrested. I was hoping to be arrested. I would have loved that.
That's
probably not the reaction that Frank was expecting for Jeff to be like, yeah, bring it on.
Come get me. I was like, I'm
he doesn't know Jeff well enough then, does he?
Take me in, baby.
Yeah. So again, just so everyone is clear on this, Frank does not live on this property. I mean, he doesn't even live there. So
no, he lives in Golden View.
He lives down the hill, kind of nearby.
And he probably, because it would be so expensive to develop that piece of property, there is a house back there that I saw that's on the, when you go up the trail, it's on the right-hand side, but it's way down in the valley.
There's a couple houses back there, way pretty far away from the trail.
Yeah, but they're on the, like, they're on, I guess it would be on the south side of the trail. They're not on the north side of the trail. So you guys, your take on it is that it really was kind of a shakedown situation. He thought he was going to get money to open this trail, or what do you think his real motivation is?
He tried to.
Yeah. But yeah, was I mean, that just like something that fell in his lap, you know?
It's really hard to know. I mean, if you've ever looked at land in Anchorage, you realize pretty quickly that land here is fairly expensive. Usually buildable land on the hillside might be $150,000 to $250,000 an acre. So I'm sure some people looking at land would see this 120 acre tract listed for $350,000 or whatever it was, and think, oh my gosh, this is the real estate steal of the century. Well, you know, people have been looking at that tract for years. There's a reason nobody's bought it. It's because development is really expensive. So I don't know if he bought it with the intention of eventually subdividing it and then realized that that wouldn't be economically feasible, or if he bought it always with the intention of trying to get money for the trail. But one of his former coworkers and friends did make a statement that Frank had always known about the trail and had always intended to buy the land and buy the lot and close the trail. And he made that statement to it at a Friends of the Stewart Trail meeting, and people were pretty shocked to hear that. But so yeah, something related to the trail, I think, was always part of the plan. I do not know why you would move to Alaska, buy a public, you know, and gate a public trail. It's just from a social perspective, it seems like such an incredible thing to do to the people that you live with in this small community.
The track behind Frank Pugh is this guy Christopher Matthew Cavanaugh, or now I believe his name is Matinaw, and he's actually selling, it's for sale now, isn't it? He's
yeah, the lots in that valley tend to be held for a while and then they change hands. And, you know, it's hard to know why people buy them, if they're buying them as investment properties, if they think that they're going to develop. I mean, it's kind of the edge of town. And but yeah, I think eventually, decades down the road, maybe something back there, there will probably be some more development back there. I can't imagine that. It seems likely that the parcels owned by the zoo and the botanical gardens will probably get sold to a public entity and kind of become part of the park.
The Matinaw guy has an RV up there he was living in, and he actually three years ago, when we were on there a separate time, he drove a truck and blocked the trail and accosted us, and it got pretty intense. He started filming us with a GoPro, Paxton started taking pictures. Yeah. It was quite uncomfortable.
Yeah, and Frank Pugh, we got a report, and actually there's a little video online too of a local family went up to walk on the Stewart Trail, and Frank in his big truck followed kind of right at their heels, just kind of creeping down the trail right behind them. You know, this guy is with his daughter, and he just found it incredibly, incredibly creepy. So it was a really bad situation up there. I mean, I certainly wasn't willing to go up there by myself. I went up, you know, as Jeff said, with late Senator Birch and Constant, but I it was a very bad situation. So I think this ruling decision, I'm not sure what the technical term is, from Judge Crosby is really important to restoring just some kind of normalcy to the situation. I mean, this whole mess just really needs to end. It's so needless. I mean, the Pew probably spent, I don't know, maybe $200,000 to $300,000, you know, fighting this. It's just, he hired a very expensive
Kevin Fitzgerald, yeah, right? Yeah, this is one of the premier lawyers, civil lawyers in the state, who's not cheap.
Oh, and the Friends of the Stewart Trail, they spent a lot of money as well. They're still trying, they're going to recoup some of their losses from Frank, but not all of them.
They crowdfunded, or they raised, you know, kind of through donations, a lot of the money. But yeah, it was, they had, and then Tom Meacham was helping them out.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not, you know, it's lawyers aren't cheap. It's a lot of time. Right. It's consuming. This thing took years for them to litigate.
And I talked to one of the board members of Friends of Stewart Trail, and he said that they're still going to have to raise more money to pay the lawyers. So,
yeah, at least they're a group of many, many people. As far as I can tell, Frank Pugh single-handedly lost potentially up to $250,000. Fighting this completely pointless legal battle.
I expect a motion for attorney's fees at some point here very soon.
They're going for partial attorney's fees. Yeah, it's a huge loss for, you know, Kevin Fitzgerald's a pretty well-known attorney.
Yeah.
really got completely trounced.
So this decision was, it's almost been 30 days. I should have checked how long it's been. We are talking on September 20th. Happy PFD day, guys.
I got mine.
Woo. Yep. We're all a lot wealthier. So I'm not sure when we're going to air, but at this time, it's been not quite 30 days yet since the decision was made, since the judge ruled. And I think he has 30 days to appeal it. And I did talk to Frank Pugh, and he said he feels like it's not settled yet. People still can't be on the trail. That's what he told me, and that he will be appealing.
We'll see.
That is, I mean, I'm not an attorney, but that's almost certainly not correct. It's,
yeah.
The judge is very clear. This is a prescriptive easement, which means that people can be on the trail. I wouldn't necessarily encourage people to use it just because it's, I think that it's a good idea to wait until these issues are more, everything is kind of settled and the temperatures come down. I mean, yeah, if.
The ruling was September 1st.
Yeah.
Oh, September 1st. So we're 20 days out.
Yeah.
Paxson, you had said that on social media, you know, don't use the trail yet. But, you know, I felt I had to do my due diligence and go out and go onto the trail before I interviewed both of you. So my brother and I were there last weekend, and we did have a Frank Pugh encounter. And that's when he told me these things. And so I've been in a little bit of contact with him. So
maybe you're going to be on YouTube soon from the game cam.
Well, yeah. And my brother, he had the camera up in, or his phone up in my brother's face. And yeah, we were somewhat worried about that. But then he also called the Beckers, who have the property next door. Mm-hmm. And we know the Beckers, my brother and I do. And they're very upset about the way this has gone and the way they've been portrayed, because they are like, we want people to enjoy this trail too. And they don't see any, they just want to solve these problems like parking and trash. Those are their big things that they, and they're on the exact same page as the Reynolds, who are, Chris Reynolds is on the board of the Friends of Stewart Trail. And their main concerns in the neighborhood are parking and trash.
So that is an incredibly interesting part of this whole story. So that section of the hillside is outside of the Park Service area for Anchorage, which means that they do not pay a single cent to maintain any of our city parks. And it also means that the city can't spend money on any parks in that area. Now, the Stewart Trail isn't a park per se, but it is... kind of absurd that a lot of the wealthiest people in Anchorage have effectively dodged taxes to maintain all of our city parks, even though of course they use our city parks. There was a vote several years ago, I believe 2017, in which that part of the hillside outside of the Park Service area got to vote about whether or not they wanted to join the Park Service area and pay the park tax like, you know, everybody in West Anchorage, South Anchorage, Mountain View, and they voted no. So to be honest, I find it a little bit hard to, I'm less sympathetic when people in those communities say, you know, oh, there's trash, there's dog. Nobody should be leaving dog poop or trash or anything at trailheads, but they're dodging the park tax. And they actually voted to make it impossible to maintain any city parks in that area. So this is in some ways, this is arguably a self-created problem, and it was created by the residents of the hillside who voted to continue to stay out of the Park Service area and dodge the tax. I can't believe that you could be, you know, a very wealthy, successful person living in a really nice house on the hillside and just say, you know, I'm not going to vote. I'm going to vote to not maintain any of our parks and trails in Anchorage. I think that's incredible. So then when those same people come back and say, you know, well, we want help maintaining the parks and trails. Oh, I don't know. I really think it's time to join the Park Service area, guys.
Yeah.
It's, you know, these people have dodged the park tax for long enough.
Mm-hmm. Let's go ahead and talk just a little bit about Campbell Lake Access, and then maybe we'll come back in the future and do another show on that. But I think I'm not positive about this, but this is how I remember, is that Jeff, you're kind of the driver on this one, right? Am I right about that? No, it's Paxton. I can see your face.
No, we worked on it together.
Well,
the
Campbell Lake's interesting because so Paxton, he kind of was aware of the one man's mountain, and he wrote that, he did that work and did that. I mean, helped out a little bit, but that was more Paxton's kind of,
that's the Stewart Trail story.
Stewart Trail story.
Right.
But with Campbell Lake, it's interesting because Paxson had many, many years ago tried to use the lake through peck rafting, and he got out. He parked, I think, and then he got out of the creek, and then some guy kind of accosted him for crossing part of the road or getting out of the creek. And you know, I moved here in 04, and you know, I didn't grow up here, but a lot of my friends did, and one even lives on the lake. And I just always was under the impression that was a private lake. That was the culture they created, but it was no public access, private lake. You have to get permission to go on there. If your friend lives there, you can, you know, have fun on the boat and go swimming or whatever, water skiing. But then Paxson had this issue with this, you know, person on, what was that, Canary Drive?
It was actually a cop. And he had his cruiser in his driveway, and he stepped out into the street and stepped in front of my car to prevent me from leaving. And he told me that it was a private street, that I had been parked on a private street, and Campbell Lake was a private lake, and you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I needed to, you know, get out of his neighborhood. And I was like, I thought Campbell Lake was a private lake too, but the guy, he went one degree too far by saying it was a public street, or sorry, a private street. And I was like, nah, you know, that's really kind of an abuse of your authority, to be honest. So I started looking into it, and you know, Jeff and I looked into it, and we found that.
Well, no, Paxson, he emailed DNR.
I'm trying to summarize a little bit.
So this is really important. It's really important.
Just give a tease for the next one.
And then a long time went by, and then Fish and Game, who manages Waterways, got back and told him, hey, it is a public, all lakes are public, here's the access. And
yeah,
he actually told me about it, and I kind of didn't really process it. Or he mentioned Senator Von Imhoff, Natasha Von Imhoff's property, and I just didn't really understand what he was saying, and I was kind of busy, and I kind of forgot about it. And then like a month goes by, and we're having dinner and drinks over at Bernard Roadhouse, and he brought it up again. And I kind of said, he said, let's go have a picnic on Natasha's easement. And because I had run against her in, you know, 2016, so we were kind of a little bit political rivals. And I was like, what do you
wait?
What?
I said that. I didn't literally mean we should do that, but
I mean, well, he's kind of joked, we can go have a picnic on this. And I said, what are you talking about? And then he showed me the email and this big document that they gave. And what it showed was they were not only aware of the public easement, Von Imhoff and her husband. They tried to get it eliminated in 2004 or five when they bought the piece of land because they wanted, you know, they wanted to build a house and they didn't want this easement there. And it was kind of partially vacated to allow for the house, but it was still there. And I remember having this epiphany. I said, wait a minute. You're telling me this state senator, one of the wealthiest people in Alaska, is not only aware of the easement, but tried to eliminate and vacate the easement to block public access? And I said, oh my God.
Yeah, I think it was a roadhouse. Talking about this.
I said, we are doing this story. Like, yeah. Oh my word, you know?
Some people suggested that we wrote it as some kind of attack on Senator Von Imhoff. It's actually completely the opposite. I was really nervous to do this story because it affected people who have a lot of you know, power in our community. I was actually like,
I wasn't nervous at all. I was nervous. I was like, let's do this.
This is why Jeff and I make a good team.
You guys are a great team.
but you know, that Campbell Lake and the Stewart Trail and a lot of other places in you know, in, around Anchorage, like Ram Valley, South Fork, gosh, there's just so many places where there are public access problems. And I think like the common thread with the Campbell Lake story and these other ones, I think a lot of people, you know, accept the appearance of their community at face value, and they drive up to a trail and it says private property, and they just say, okay, oh, it's private property, I need to leave. Or Campbell Lake, oh, it's just a private lake. I think it's really important. Like, what I've really enjoyed doing in these stories is digging a little bit and figuring out, you know, what decisions led to the city being the shape it is now. Because the reality is every single issue related to public access is a result of a decision or a set of decisions by private individuals, government entities, et cetera. And a lot of what appears to be the case, or a lot of what we just accept to be true about our community is actually, or about public access specifically, is just, sometimes it's just misleading, or it's unclear, or it's just absolutely downright false. I mean, mm-hmm. Years ago, you had even Governor Sheffield put up a bunch of no parking signs on his public street.
Oh,
and
yeah, I
people
that.
Just, you know, accepted it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I really enjoy doing these stories. They take a little bit of time, obviously, to do, you know, records requests, emails, et cetera. But I think when you start poking at this veneer of like, you know, no public access, private property signs, a lot of this, you know, a shocking amount just falls apart.
Well,
and there's a lot more access and the public has a lot more rights than they realize. And a lot of people get away with things just because of complicity and acceptance. And, you know, I would really encourage other people, like, start poking around, like, hey, that trail that somebody closed down, did they really have a right to do that? Like, is that on a section line easement? There are a lot of cases where the public has an absolutely ironclad right to access places or do things like Campbell Lake. And it just takes a little bit of prodding and the whole thing falls apart.
And then
it really changed. And there's really no going back. Right?
This is why the freedom of the press is so important, because, mm-hmm. you know, I've learned through the landmine, just different, whatever political issue or land issue. You know, we did this Campbell Lake article for 50 years. You know, there's this ruse, this wool pulled over the eyes of people in Anchorage by these people on Campbell Lake that it was a private lake. People tried to get access. I mean, Tony Knowles tried to get access at one point when he was governor, and he was rebuffed. You know, there was attempts over the years to get access. Nobody, even the governor of Alaska, couldn't do it. We do this article. Within 3 months of this article coming out, the city and the state government both came out with a joint statement. You know, three months in 50 years, this thing happened was kind of conventional wisdom. So mm-hmm. I just think, you know, the free press and being able to write about these things and expose them or cover them is crucial. And I've always said, you know, understood the importance of the First Amendment, but I mean, really just from seeing what it can actually accomplish that the highest levels of government couldn't do.
These stories in particular, I think are really, should be near and dear to Alaskans and listeners of Outdoor Explorer, because, you know, this is as Alaskans, we like to be back where there aren't any cars, or even in a neighborhood where we have access to recreating on a lake. I mean, these things are really important to us as Alaskans. And if private landowners would slowly close everything down, so we wouldn't have access to them. So I really am thankful that you guys are out there and doing this really great investigative work, because you guys cover all your bases, and that's what I really enjoy about your articles. They're really long, and so sometimes it takes me, you know, I can't always sit through one. I might have to get up and go get a cup of coffee or whatever, but well, I'm really enjoying them. Keep up the good work. I want to have you guys back again, and maybe we'll go into, you know, more detail on Campbell Lake, and after I talk to some of the other players and stuff, maybe we'll do more and make this a series. I've really, really enjoyed talking with you guys. It was a lot of fun. Thanks for joining me today, Jeff and Paxson.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Yeah, it was great.
That's it for today's show. Thanks to my guests, Jeff Lanfield and Paxson Welber. You can find pictures of the Stuart Trail gate and a link to the original and follow-up landmine Stuart Trail articles on the Outdoor Explorer page at alaskapublic.org. Next week in part two of the Stuart Trail, my guests are Chris Reynolds and Kelly Becker. Chris is the treasurer of Friends of the Stuart Public Trail, and Kelly is a longtime property owner adjacent to the trail. The show is produced by Eric Bork. My name is Lisa Keller, and from all of our hosts here at Outdoor Explorer, thanks for listening, and we'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.